From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, we're featuring some of our favorite entertainment and pop culture interviews of the year. Today, we hear from New York Times media columnist David Carr. He wrote about his addiction and recovery in his memoir, The Night of the Gun. He gave some advice about how to be direct with interviewees, advice I haven't yet tried.
If they don't engage, I just tell them, well, you know what, you better put the nut cup on because this is not going to be pleasant for anyone.
Also, songwriters Gillian Welch and David Rawlings perform some songs from their latest album to spread some musical holiday joy.
We've kind of said that this record is 10 different kinds of sad, and there being 10 songs on it.
That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During this holiday week, we're featuring a retrospective of some of our favorite entertainment and pop culture interviews of the year. Up next, we have David Carr. He writes a weekly column in the New York Times about developments in all forms of media, including print, digital, film, radio, and TV. He also writes about popular culture for the Times Culture section. He told a more personal story about his addiction to drugs and alcohol and his recovery in his 2008 memoir, The Night of the Gun. This year, Carr was prominently featured in the documentary Page One, which followed the New York Times media desk for a year. The film will have its TV premiere New Year's Eve at 6 p.m. Eastern on the History Channel. My interview with David Carr was recorded in October. At the beginning of the film, at the beginning of the documentary Page One, you're on the phone with a source, and you're saying to your source, "I see this as a big story. I could probably get significant space. What do you think the story is that I should tell?" I thought that was such a really interesting way of putting it. Do you say that a lot to sources? What's the story you think I should tell?
You know, we are people who just show up and declare ourselves as instant experts on all manner of stories, and we often are only taking a very sort of blunt force guess about what's going on. And I think it always behooves us just to ask the people, especially if you're aspiring to do something good, what do you think's going on? What do you think this is about?
And do you use that question especially when you know there's going to be conflicting points of view on a story and you're talking to representatives of those different points of view?
Well, I strive for congruence. And by that, I mean there's an interview near the end of the movie with officials at the Tribune Company. It's far less friendly. It's far more declarative. And I'm telling the person at the other end of the phone what I think the story is about. I don't want to be sort of a poodle dog when I'm out there and a friendly sort of presence in people's lives and then come back and do something that's really mean or aggressive. And if it's going to be a hard story, one of the things I always say is, this is going to be a really serious story and I'm asking very serious questions and it behooves you to think it through and really work on answering and defending yourself, because this is not a friendly story. And if they don't engage, I just tell them, well, you know what? You better put the nut cup on, because this is not going to be pleasant for anyone. I worked at a weekly with a lot of young reporters, and I would hear them pouring on the honey on the phone and being real sweet and nice with the people that they talked to, and then they would turn in these stories that were scabrous and really mean. And I said, well, you're setting this up so the phone call is going to come to me, not you. And you haven't done these people the privilege of giving them an opportunity to defend themselves. I don't think people who read your work, who were involved as sources, should be surprised. I often read significant parts of the story to the people that are involved, because I don't want to sit up in the middle of the night and wonder whether I was fundamentally unfair to the person, that I didn't communicate to them what is coming, and that they'll be genuinely surprised. I don't want anybody to open up one of my stories and have their nose broken by what they read. Although, you know, I do got to say, at the beginning of the week, I wrote a really mean column and I didn't tell anybody involved. So I guess that's not always true.
You had a story that was headlined, "Why Not Occupy Newsrooms?" And you were basically asking how come there isn't an Occupy movement in newspapers, because newspaper executives are guilty of some of the same things that bank executives are. Make the analogy for us.
In the instance of Gannett, Gannett is a publicly held company that owns 82 newspapers across America, in towns big and small, dailies and weeklies. And in the past 6 years, they've gone from 52,000 employees to 32,000 employees. Their stock price, which is the general metric of publicly held companies' health, went from $75 a share to about $10 a share. The guy who oversaw it, the CEO, Craig Dubow, when he left, received $37 million in health compensation and disability benefits. And I mean, to me, the Occupy movement, a lot of people tag it as socialist or communist. I just think it's people who are angry about capitalism not working. If you make bad choices, you pay the price. In this instance, and at the Tribune Company, which I also wrote about, the chief executives made choices that resulted in a lot of people getting rolled out of the back of the truck. Now, it was a very challenging environment for newspapers, but I don't think that people should benefit in the tens of millions of dollars for just firing people. There's no innovation there. There's no magic to that. And I don't think that kind of sort of thinking and strategy should be rewarded. So I just wrote what was basically a screed. And oddly enough, I was writing about newspapers and it totally connected on Twitter. And I thought, well, Twitter does not care about newspapers, and yet this thing is rolling over and over again, being retweeted thousands of times. I got probably 300 emails. What it is, it's about the trashing of once great American institutions, and that's a story that the general public never tires of.
Now, when you started talking about this, you described the article as, was mean the word you used?
It was mean.
So what was different in terms of how you handled this article and how you typically handle articles that are investigative or critical of the organization that you're writing about?
Well, I had done a story a few months ago about Gannett's bonuses, and I spent 4 days trying to get the company to comment on what they did. And on Sunday night, just before a deadline, they said, we're not going to have any comment on these bonuses. And I just said, really? Your newspaper company, your publicly held company, these bonuses are a matter of public record, and you have nothing to say about them. And I just found that appalling. And I think some of that was sort of reflected in the fact that, A, I didn't bother to call them, and B, that I was angry after I'd written about their last set of bonuses that they clearly were living a life beyond consequence, and they just stepped up and did it again and gave this guy a huge bag of money on the way out the door.
What's your typical media diet in the course of a day or a week?
When I wake up in the morning, the gun goes off, I'm checking Twitter, I'm checking RSS feeds, and I get 4 newspapers at my house every day. I get the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, the Star Ledger, because I live in New Jersey, and of course the New York Times. And the reason I do is because the day before this, all this stuff has gone whizzing past me, and I seem to know a lot, but I don't really know what part of it is important. And I used to think it was so silly that newspapers would, like, I'd go to our page one meeting, and they'd be organizing this hierarchy of the 6 or 7 most important stories in Western civilization. Meanwhile, the web is above them, pivoting and eliding, and all these stories are morphing and changing. I thought, well, how silly is this? But you know what? I came to want that resting place where someone yelled stop and decided, look, this is stuff you need to know about going forward. Newspapers have become a kind of magazine experience for me where they're where it's a way to look back at what has happened.
Do you ever feel like your brain isn't really equipped to sort through and synthesize all the information that you're inputting into your brain?
I'm sorry, what was the question? I'm kidding, Terry. Yes, I worry about it constantly because, number one, in writing terms, if I become good on Twitter, will I lose my ability to think long thoughts? Number two, my nightstand is groaning with Netflix, with an iPad, with books you know, my friends have written about things I'm interested in and I haven't gotten to them, so it sort of implicates me. Meanwhile, you know, I walk through Times Square and I see messages on a zipper. I go to buy groceries, there's more messages. I ride the elevator up here, there's more messages. And I think that it does sort of paralyze you. My more sort of persistent concern is that I will become so busy producing media that I won't consume enough of it so that what I produce becomes less and less rich over time. When you're in the middle of things and pushing out a lot of information, you really have no idea what's going on because you have no time to watch or listen or consume. That's my problem at 55 years old. I don't notice it among my younger colleagues. They don't. Brian Stelter, who's also in the film, the act of producing media and consuming media, those are not discrete things to him. He does both at the same time in a way I don't. I can remember when Bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces, about the time I was going, maybe we should do a blog post about this, I opened up the media blog that I work on, and Brian Stelter, my colleague, already had 700 words up there. And so I'm like, you know, it's like I'm working through Jell-O and he's not. He's in a different sort of universe. But I'm familiar with all the platforms, have engaged in them. I mean, I set up a fully equipped studio in my basement and wrote and edited video and sent it out to the world every day. They ended up looking like hostage videos. They were horrible. You could almost smell the dead bodies. But it's still, I got the experience and I learned to do it. And I've never understood some of my colleagues saying, oh, that crap's for someone else. It's like, that maybe would have worked 5 years ago, but that isn't going to work anymore.
My guest is David Carr. He writes a weekly media column for the New York Times, and he's featured in the documentary Page One about the New York Times media desk. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Carr, and he writes about the business of media and about popular culture for the New York Times. His media column is Mondays in the business section. A few years ago, you wrote a very personal memoir about being addicted and recovering from the addictions, and the addictions were coke and crack, and you had alcohol problems, too. The book is called Night of the Gun. And, you know, I'm just wondering, like, did the New York Times, when you got your job, after you were clean, after you were sober and you got your job with the New York Times, how much did they know about the addiction part of your past? I mean, it's not the kind of thing you put on your resume, but did you talk to them about it?
I think I actually did.
Did you really?
In terms of, like, my communication to them. I mean, part of... I didn't want there to be any surprises about sort of who I am and what I've done. What I tried to emphasize is, you know, I was a very low bottom, poly addicted, crackhead drunk, whatever you want to call it, number of misdemeanor arrests, violence against all sorts of people. And what I wanted to point out is that since then, you know, I'd been a single parent, I had gotten off of welfare, that I had taken any number of assignments and done a good job, that I had run newspapers, that I had done a few things since then. But still, when I did the book, you know, I went to my boss, Sam Sifton, at the time, and he said, I'll walk the book down there, but I think you probably should do it. And I said, well, do you have a pair of tongs or oven mitts or something that I can use to hand it over? Because it was it's kind of a dark book. And when I gave it to him, Bill Keller said, you know what, we don't hire nuns, we have no problem with your book. You know, they said they were proud of the book. But
getting back to them hiring you, you know, before the book existed, they were okay with it? Like, you told them your story and they had faith that you would remain sober and do a good job?
Yeah, it's not something that we committed to directly. I mean, I didn't, in fact, remain sober. So, and I don't think that that's part of the contract. I did try drinking again. It didn't go very well. My work never suffered per se. My work rarely did. It's always the last thing to go. But if you took all of the functioning alcoholics and addicts out of the American economy, you'd be taking out a lot of firepower and a lot of talent. In the main, while I've been at the New York Times, I've been completely sober, highly productive, true to my word, doing my best like everyone else there to get it right. But they don't, I've seen people at the Times tumble and get in personal trouble. And you know what? That place, it's weird, but it will pick you up and accommodate all manner of human frailties because people are pushed to the limit at the place. And when somebody stumbles, it's an incredibly humane place. And I know that sounds gooey and horrible. And I never really needed it or required it, but I've seen, it's like when you're on deadline there and you really can't quite get it done and there's not enough room. And somehow everyone around you will sort of lift you up and throw you across the goal line. And then you're the one who stands up the next day and puts your arms above your head because you made a touchdown. Everybody there is working very hard to make it better.
So this question is probably way too personal. So just,
I bet not.
Well, just tell me if it is, because I don't want to be intrusive. For a lot of people who are giving up an addiction, they're encouraged to like find a higher power that they can, you know, turn to and believe in, whether it's religion or something else that will function in that way. Was there such a thing for you?
You know, it's funny you should mention that because I'm in the middle of sort of a struggle with that. And it's not that I am a church-going Catholic, and I do that as a matter of, it's good to stand with my family. It's good that I didn't have to come up with my own creation myth for my children. It's a wonderful group of people that I go to church with, and it's community. It's not really where I find God. And sort of what the accommodation I've reached is a very jerry-rigged one, which is all along the way in recovery, I've been helped, without getting into the names of specific groups, by all of these strangers, you know, who get in a room and do a form of group talk therapy and live by certain rules in their life. And one of the rules is that you help everyone who needs help. And I think to myself, well, that seems remarkable. And not only is that not a general human impulse, but it's not an impulse of mine. And yet I found myself doing that over and over again. So am I, underneath all things, just a really wonderful, giving person, or is there a force greater than myself that is leading me to act in ways that are altruistic and not self-interested and lead to the greater good? And so that's sort of as far as I've gotten with the higher power thing. Is I'm, you know, I'm kind of a pirate, kind of a thug. I mean, I've done a bunch of terrible things, and yet I'm able to, for the most part, be a decent person. How is that? Do I have some inner strength of character? I think not. I think something else is working on me. You know, I think it's okay to sort of like have a superstitious belief in God and not really have thought it through. I think it's okay to just, I think there's freedom in allowing for the possibility of it. Like, I don't have a presence. I don't have some idea in my mind of a woman or a man figure or anything like that. But I find the spaces between people, whether I'm making a newspaper with them or in recovery or living with them as family or friends, or I find something really godly in that. I don't have trouble acknowledging that.
So your voice has a kind of hoarseness to it.
Right.
A little raspy. Was it always that way, or is that related to the drugs that you did back then, or to the cancer that you had after that?
You know, it's a little tough to pin down because I've smoked on and on all my life tobacco. A lot of people who smoke tobacco sound like me. When you smoke cocaine, you're taking in vapors that are coming into your lungs at a really high temperature. Could that have made a problem? I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I took a lot of radiation to the mouth and throat. So could it have been that? I mean, I have, I walk around, and you can see in the movie, page one, I walk around with my neck bent. That's from the muscles sort of getting shot out by all the radiation. I will tell you something interesting, though. I spent a couple weeks working 9/11, you know, working the pile. Just my job was to cover a fireman. I never had a hoarse voice before that.
Really?
Yeah. So I think that's when it declared itself. And it sort of comes and goes based on the amount of fatigue I have. I could have surgery to remove the vocal notes, but I've had a lot of surgeries. I've had a very medicalized life. I have no spleen. I have one kidney. I have no gallbladder. I have half a pancreas. And the idea of sort of willingly allowing people to cut into me, I'm probably not for that. I'll just deal with the hoarseness of the voice.
Well, David Carr, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to speak with you, Terry.
My interview with David Carr was recorded in October. He writes a media column for the New York Times, published Mondays in the business section, and he's prominently featured in the documentary Page One about the Times Media Desk. It will have its TV premiere Saturday on the History Channel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CITCO, whose charitable giving program supports communities in a variety of ways. Learn more at fuelinggood.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from Anne and John Herman, supporting the Children's Radio Foundation, giving voice to African youth through community radio, childrensradiofoundation.org. This is NPR.
I'm on the dark side.
Coming up, an in-studio concert and conversation with Gillian Welch and David Rawlings as we continue our retrospective of some of our favorite entertainment and pop culture interviews of the year. Welch and Rawlings released their long-awaited album, The Harrow and the Harvest, last summer.
Your blue serape, it fits my mood. I'm through with baboons. I'm through with food. Somebody's calling, trying to track me down. And if I don't answer, I'd hang around. I slide past lovers, lost in the dark. For building art, I can't remember when I felt so free.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a retrospective of some of our favorite entertainment and pop culture interviews of the year. Gillian Welch and David Rawlings performed a few songs for us in July after the release of their album, The Harrow and the Harvest. Welch and Rawlings are music partners and life partners. They perform original songs inspired by bluegrass, folk, classic country, and hymns. Although they work as a duo, they perform and record under the name Gillian Welch. Rawlings has one album under the name The Dave Rawlings Machine. Many listeners were introduced to Welch by her performances on the Grammy Award-winning soundtrack, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Her music is steeped in Southern tradition, but she was born in New York. Her family moved to L.A. when she was 3, when her parents got a job writing music for the Carol Burnett Show. Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings now live in Nashville. She sings and plays guitar and banjo. He sings and plays lead guitar. Gillian Welch, Dave Rawlings, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. I'd like you to start by playing the song The Way It Goes from your new album, The Harrow and the Harvest. Gillian, would you introduce it for us?
Yeah, this is, definitely the fastest song on the record. Perhaps the only song with real tempo. And it goes like this.
Becky Johnson by the farm, put a needle in her arm. That's the way that it goes, that's the way. And her brother laid her down in the cold Kentucky ground. That's the way that it goes, that's the way. That's the way that it goes. Everybody's buying little baby clothes. That's the way that it ends. Though there was a time when she and I were friends. And Miranda ran away, took a cat and left L.A. That's the way that it goes, that's the way. Sell that pussy cat. That's the way that it goes. That's the way. That's the way that it goes. Everybody's buying little baby clothes. That's the way that it ends. Though there was a time when he and I were friends. The brightest one. Early in October fall, that's the way that it goes, that's the way. While the dark ones go to bed with good whiskey in their heads, that's the way that it goes, that's the way. Down well, did she leave him for that swell? That's the way that it goes, that's the way. That's the way that it goes. Everybody's buying little baby clothes. That's the way that it ends. Well, there was a time when all of us were friends. Did you miss my gentle touch? Did I hurt you very much? That's the way that it goes, that's the way.
Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings performing at NPR West, their song The Way It Goes from the new Gillian Welch album, The Harrow and the Harvest. That really sounded great. You know, listening to that song, of course, you have to think, gee, do they know a lot of drug addicts? So, like, do you write songs that are biographical or songs that are just like based on characters or genres. Even a line like, when they lay me down to rest, leave a pistol in my vest. Now, I know that you really aren't going to ask for a pistol when you die, but it strikes me as a real genre line.
I feel like that line is kind of typical of when Dave and I will use cowboy language or folk language just to let people know there's an understood toughness in that line. To me, well, you understand how this person went through life.
You know, in my mind, that had to do with not knowing what's coming. And I thought that that's a sort of elegant way to put, you don't know what's coming after the grave. And you might want to be prepared in one way or another.
Can I ask you to do a song from the new album? And this one is Hard Times. Gillian, would you introduce it?
You know, this is another, we've kind of half-jokingly said that this record is 10 different kinds of sad, and there being 10 songs on it.
So this is sadness number 6.
This is sadness number 6, kind of dealing with loss, a particular kind of loss when you lose something you didn't even realize you were losing and not realizing the value of it until it's gone. So here you go. Hard times ain't gonna rule my mind no more.
There was a captain man used to plow and sing. He loved that mule, and a mule loved him. When the day got long, as it does about now, I'd hear him singing to his muley cow, calling, come on, my sweet old girl, and I'd bet
Nice. That's Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings doing Hard Times from the new Gillian Welch album, The Harrow and the Harvest. Thanks so much for playing that for us. Is there a story behind the song about like what inspired the images in it?
I started writing that one at the end of working on Dave's record, the Dave Rawlings Machine Friend of a Friend record. And Levon Helm was going to be coming in to play some drums on the record. So I was thinking about Levon, and it's always been very inspiring for me to think about other musicians and trying to write songs that they would like. And so I know that song got started me thinking, well, what kind of song would Levon like when he came in? I mean, I've kind of done this before. That's Orphan Girl got started with a very similar train of thought. I was driving and I was thinking, what kind of song would Ralph Stanley like? Like, that was me trying to write a song with nothing in it that would be a deal breaker for Ralph Stanley to, like, you know what I mean? That it was that sort of legitimate.
I'm glad you brought up that song because I love that song. Would you mind if I asked you to do a chorus of that song?
We can do a little bit of that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very short system. Let's do just a little verse into the chorus. Yeah, yeah.
I am an orphan on God's highway, but I share my troubles while you go my way. I have no mother, no father, no sister, no brother. I am an orphan girl. I have had friendships pure and golden, but the ties of kinship I have not known them. I know no mother, no father, no sister, no brother. I am an orphan girl. I am an orphan girl.
My guests are Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. We'll hear them perform more songs after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are songwriters and musicians Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. Their latest album is called The Harrow and the Harvest. They're performing some songs for us. Can I ask you to do an excerpt of your song, By the Mark, which is about, you know, the nails and the cross? And it sounds like it could be a very old song, but it's actually one of your originals. I will know my Savior.
So that's a great song written by my guests Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings, and they're performing for us today and talking about their music. I know that you've been very inspired by the Stanley Brothers and Bill Monroe and the Leuven Brothers. And those are all like male harmony groups, and you're, you know, a man and a woman singing harmony together. Can you talk about working out your harmonies for songs like the one we just heard?
Yeah, well, first of all, you've touched upon something. We are incredibly lucky that coming out of the kind of rural American duet tradition, which is mostly two men, we're so lucky.
Generally brothers, actually.
Generally brothers, yeah. We are necessarily different than that. You know, we're never going to sound, nothing we do is ever going to sound like the Stanley Brothers or the Blue Sky Boys. It's necessarily going to be different because we've got a woman singing lead and then a man singing baritone.
Yeah, most of those groups all had the melody was on the bottom and the harmony was sung above. And so when we started emulating that music, we had to sort of figure out a slightly different way to do it. And, you know, to this day, we'll sit down and I'll try to sing through pretty much any note you can think of and look for things that I think are interesting or that, you know, that tickle my ear. And then once I found a little part that I'm committed to, sort of build on either side.
And, yeah. And Dave's ear and his mind is so facile that he will run through many, many note choices. And he'll hit one and it'll have that special kind of little wiggle and little buzz, and both of us will look up and say, okay, that one, there's one, you know, there's one keeper note, and then we'll just keep going and he'll construct the part. You know, I know a number of singers who call Dave their hands down favorite harmony singer. And
Red right now. I'm so glad this is
so
radio.
Embarrassed. Yeah.
Gillian, is there a note that you can think of, like a passage or a note in that song or another song that gives you one of those, like, that's it kind of moments in terms of his harmony?
The entrance to the third verse.
Do you want an example?
Oh, here.
Yes.
We don't need to get up, but...
So, do you want to show him what a normal person would do?
I don't know. It's all normal to me.
What note, what word are we listening for in this line?
It's the entrance. It's on Calvary
it's
Mountain.
It's the first syllable of...
Yeah, it's that thing.
So over the chords, that's a bit odd. It's like a suspension. Not many people would open a verse that way.
So we're listening to the entrance right now?
Yes.
Okay.
On Calvary Mountain, where they made him suffer so, all my sin was paid for a long, long time ago.
So there you go.
My guests are Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. They'll play two more songs after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Gillian Welch and David Rawlings, songwriters and musicians. They're going to perform another song that's featured on their latest album, The Harrow and the Harvest. The song is called Dark Turn of Mind.
Take me and love me if you want me. Don't ever treat me unkind, 'cause
that's Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings performing Dark Turn of Mind, which is on their new album, The Harrow and the Harvest. Before we end, you know, what I often do at the end of interviews with performers is ask them to surprise us with a song that we might not think that they like or that isn't typical for them, and to perform it and tell us why they love it. Would you be up for doing that?
Yeah, sure. You want us to just pick the song?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll do White Rabbit. How's that?
That's surprising.
Okay.
Very surprising. And why are you doing it?
We discovered one day accidentally in soundcheck, we were doing our sound at this club and the reverb was kind of broken or the wrong setting was on. And I started singing and I was just drenched in reverb. And it immediately put me in mind of Grace Slick. And I started singing White Rabbit. And all the guys... Dave and our sound man, everyone just died. So we've actually done it live a couple times. We did it on the, we just finished a tour with the Buffalo Springfield reunion tour, and we actually played it.
Yeah, we pulled it out a couple times.
Yeah.
So we'll give you a little gem, a little shot of that here.
Gillian Welch, Dave Rawlings, it's been so much fun to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for performing for us and talking with us. And thanks to the engineers at NPR West, where you are right now. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Terry. We had a good time, and thanks for having us on the show.
Yes, thank you.
¶¶
That's Gillian Welch and David Rawlings, recorded last July. Their Fresh Air performance of White Rabbit is on iTunes. Their latest album is called The Harrow and the Harvest. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting research on how social factors like housing and jobs affect health. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, celebrating 20 years of being a source for what works in education. More at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series featuring some of our favorite entertainment and pop culture interviews of the year. We'll listen back to one of our most moving interviews of the year with Maurice Sendak, best known for the children's books Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. And we'll hear from Danny Burstein, co-star of the Broadway revival of Follies. Join us.